Welcome, everyone, to this week's episode of Reanimated. I am H.A. Conrad here on the East Coast at Ground Zero of the coronavirus apocalypse, joined by my intrepid co-host on the West Coast, Stuart Tiffin. Hello, Stuart.
Hey, H.A. Emphasis on the Reanimated.
Correct. And today we are going to be talking about one of my favorite shows that has come out of late in terms of the zombie genre. But honestly, pretty much a lot of genres. I mean, I think this is awesome, but we are going to be talking about Kingdom Season 2. And we really liked Season 1, so we're going to get into that. And we're going to be talking about Episode 1 today. And ahead of that, we have a bit of news. I think we're gonna skip over the coronavirus update today.
I'm not because it's not important, but yeah, I think we can,
you know, good news in New York. We're a bit on a plateau in terms of newer cases, but still lots of deaths, unfortunately, but hopefully we are on the downward trajectory of this thing. But we have a couple of things to talk about related to this and reopening. So we'll get into that in a moment. You found this awesome little Insta message from Ruben Blades of Fear the Walking Dead fame and other things, obviously. And I thought it was really sweet.
Yeah, he's just a sweet man, isn't he? And he's doing a message from AMC. And AMC is doing, I guess, a series of these, because there's one by Maggie Grace also, of We're in This Together. And just like a little heartfelt testimonial. We'll put that in the show notes in case anybody wants to feel uplifted by Daniel Salazar.
I know. He's so great. He was really... I thought his little comment about the cat was adorable.
Of course, he has a cat in real life, right?
Yep. Another bit of good news that you found that I had not seen was that apparently Blood Quantum is going to be released on streaming.
There's a caveat here, right? Yeah, because all the Facebook posts that they're putting out say... Good news, Canada. And I'm like, well, I know it's a Canadian production. Maybe they're just like being Canada first and all. But then they say it's like going to be on Amazon Prime in Canada and iTunes. But then I don't know that there are real hard borders between Canada and the U.S. as far as streaming goes. So we'll have to see.
Right. But
either way, this is coming up pretty soon. Like on the 28th, I think. Was that the date?
Yeah. April 28th. So not too far away. Even though April feels like it's forever right now. let's talk about the Corona Zombies first, which is this exploitation bit of a film that basically cops a lot of different things from different places. I don't know that we need to watch this. What do you think?
I think we will eventually, or yes, I would like to watch it, I think, although it doesn't sound even remotely good. But what I think is interesting is this article is from Film School Rejects. It's talking about exploitation films, and in the case of Corona Zombies, like, I guess they ran into a lot of too soon sort of feedback when they first talked about releasing this, the people behind it, and the film... School Rejects piece talks about there's a long history of movies and other content coming out really close to events like Waco or The Zodiac Killer that were basically made for TV or films being released as these events were unfolding. This has its roots in popular culture, and you can argue that it's too soon, but they also make the argument at the end of the article, there will probably be some Oscar contender material coming out about coronavirus down the line. And, you know, all of it draws its inspiration from the same place. And so it's legit in its own schlocky way.
I kind of think it's just what humans do during times like this. So,
yeah,
you know, and lastly, in terms of the news piece of this, and we have one more bit just to talk about Kingdom, but there was a lot of protests this week in various places, in Texas, in Ohio, in Michigan, and in California too, I think, a little bit. And these protests were by people who want everything to reopen. And, you know, I know that there is somewhat of a plateau, but the problem is that if you reopen and there's a resurgence, as we have seen in other places, including South Korea, by the way, you know, there is, and Japan, there, those are two places that seemed to have had it much more under control than we currently do. And they're seeing that they're having to shut down different places again because they have seen a resurgence of the virus. And I don't know how you felt, Stuart, but seeing all those people out there without masks and all close together was really kind of terrifying. And to me, a slap in the face of all the frontline healthcare workers that have been putting themselves on the line. And I get it. I get people are scared, and I understand the economic issues here. But, you know, economic issues don't matter if you're dead. And there was one specific photo that really looked very much like a zombie apocalypse film, and lots of people commented on it, including Michael Cetrazemis and Tom Savini and other people who have made zombie movies. And most interestingly, it looked a lot like the Shaun of the Dead posters, like promo posters. And, you know, one thing I will say is that some of the arguments by some of these people is that in those areas, they say that there are not that many cases, which is not true. I think it's all to scale. And most recently, I don't know if you've been tracking it, but in South Dakota, there is a major meat supplier that provides like a pretty large percentage of the meat around the country. It's like where stuff gets sent, gets cut up, packaged and sent out. And basically, it is the biggest hotspot right now in the Midwest, from what I understand. In some of those states, it's in South Dakota, I believe, and it's Smithfield is the name of the meat plant. And they have something like 628 cases just from that factory, and they've had to shut it down. And so I think that that kind of thing where you're saying, hey, we're in the middle of nowhere and this isn't affecting us is obviously not true. This affects everybody, and you can't fight this kind of like piecemeal, unfortunately. And anyway, that's all I'm going to say about that. But I just I just couldn't believe all those people were out there without masks. They really it to me, it's just like a terrifying thing to do. And I don't know what's going to happen from that, but it just seems like an ill-advised plan.
This is a real catch-22, frankly, and I'm seeing it in my local community also, because we've effectively flatten the curve. We only have two deaths. We have like 180 cases in Sonoma in a population of 500,000. We're doing super well, but that success leads to this curve of, this isn't a big deal. Why are we still having to stay at home? And why is my tchotchke making business closed down? Damn you, government. And it's a catch 22. And I don't feel like there's any way around that kind of reaction to the success of social distancing, that yes, and we undo it, and who knows? I personally am going to. I'm pretty confident that our public officials here are going to make the right decisions, whether there are protests or not, which could scare people, especially libertarian types who don't want a lot of power in the government, and that's going to be in this country a real problem. And this is something I've been thinking a lot about, actually, is like this concept of American exceptionalism, which some countries look to us and say, oh, you know what, every American thinks that they're hot shit, and that's why they go out and accomplish a lot. But it also leads to a complete lack of cohesive response to things like this pandemic, in my opinion, where we end up with too many people thinking they're hot shit and that the rules don't apply to them. And so this is part of why we have people on the steps of the Capitol in Detroit, which is one of the hotspots in the nation, and so on, right? So it's, I think we're a little bit the victim of our own kind of culture here.
We are, and I also look. I think I also understand the fear about the economic issues, because look, we've got a lot of, there's clearly an economic disparity in this country, and the people who are most hurt by all of this are getting even more hurt the longer this goes on. An example I will give, and you and I talked about this before we got into the podcast, is that at least here in New York, the sections of the population that are most hit are people that aren't able to stay home. They're considered to be essential workers. So, for example, the MTA is just one group of people, and they tend to live in specific neighborhoods that are now the hardest hit by the coronavirus. And I think
part of it, non-New Yorkers, this is your public transportation. authority. Right?
Oh, sorry. Yeah. And you know, all the like, and this is, I'm generalizing a little bit, but like, for example, Manhattan has not been hit as hard as you would imagine. And if you look at sort of the heat map of the area where the hot spots are, they're all the spots where you've got, you know, economically depressed neighborhoods, but also, working class neighborhoods where the people, you know, we're talking about people who have to go and work in the grocery stores and have to, you know, and healthcare workers and, you know, all that kind of thing. But Manhattan is pretty, like, either people have left because they have second homes places or they're able to quarantine. And some of these neighborhoods, especially in Elmhurst in Queens and Jackson Heights in Queens, are definitely the hardest hit. These are the places where there are refrigerated trucks to hold the bodies and they just can't hold them all. Mm. And, you know, so that is, and I think you're going to see that played out across the country, honestly, where you've got people that just cannot afford to stay home. And if they can, you know, then how do you pay the rent? There is a problem here in New York where they gave, basically, they put a rule in place that said that they're not allowed to evict people, but they still owe all of that rent. So if you've got people that are living pretty close to the bone anyway, and then they come out at the end of this and they owe like 3 or 4 months of rent, how will they ever catch up? I don't know. You know, so they have done nothing for rent relief for the people who most need it here. And I will say that despite the fact that I think a lot of people are receiving those government checks, those are a drop in the bucket. Those don't even cover rent in most parts of New York. So, mm-hmm. you know, so anyway, I get the panic and I can see why it happens, but it's not going to help us. So I don't know. I guess we'll have to kind of see how the situation goes over the next few weeks. And related to this, there was an article in the Hollywood Reporter with the people who made Kingdom. And they are the creators of this series were talking about what it was like to release this show during a pandemic. And yep. It was really pretty much spot on. It got released right as this was all coming to a head. It had already been happening, you know, obviously in Korea and China and things like that, but it had not yet hit in the US, and it was released right here in the US almost right at the sort of like when the wave was washing over us here. Mm-hmm. So I thought it was kind of an interesting little article. What did you think?
Yeah, I like the back and forth with the creators. Obviously the translation is actually very good, but they both use the word refrain, which I thought was an interesting word anyway, yeah. As someone who has done a lot of translation work before, I noticed some stuff in the text. The one huge takeaway at the end of this that I noticed was I forget which guy, maybe one of the showrunners, was like, I think we could develop this to season 10.
I did catch that. I also caught, and I don't know if you laughed and thought of me when you saw this, but one of the things I loved the most about the reception of the first season was how much people loved the hats. So they tried to put more hats into the second season, which I think is just awesome.
Well, there is, in this first episode we're going to look at today, there is a lovingly hat placement scene by Mu Yong to Prince uh-huh. Lee Chang.
Yep.
Your hat.
and they basically, and I know it's a bit of the truth, but they were like, we were surprised at the positive response to all the hats. So we tried to give the people what they wanted in the second season. And I was like, this is amazing.
What pandering.
Awesome. Anyway, I thought it was a pretty good interview with them. And, you know, I do like how they talk a lot about how this isn't just a zombie film, which it isn't. It's a lot about economic disparity and class disparity. And it's also about different political leaders creating narratives to suit their own purposes and their own power struggle.
Huh.
So that was a little bit of what they were saying in this article, which I thought was pretty cool. And in general, I'm just a huge fan of this. So I would be really happy to see this go to 10 seasons.
It's still got 100%. Well, season 2 has 100% fresh rating on Rotten Tomatoes.
Yeah. So. I will take all the hats they want to throw at us for as many seasons as they want at this point. Yeah. Admittedly, I'm very early on into this season, so maybe I'll change my mind. But I can't imagine. It's a really beautifully shot show, and they manage, there's a pretty large cast of characters, and I'm always impressed with how they're able to kind of shift the different storylines and viewpoints without it being too overwhelming.
I was, okay, so we're getting into it now, right?
We're talking about Kingdom, now we're gonna jump in. Season 2, episode 1.
I was supposed to watch 2 episodes. I only watched the first one because I'm a doof, but so sorry. HA watched both of them. We're going to try and keep it to just episode 1 today.
I'm going to try. You know I have a problem with this, but I wasn't going to out you. I wasn't going to out you, Stuart, but okay.
So one of the problems that I had not having gone back and watched any of season 1 before that we started with this was it's been a year plus since I've seen any of this show, and I felt like I could have used a primer or a glossary on who's who because I couldn't remember anybody's names. So, you know, I'm looking at the Wikipedia now, and yes, and as the show went on, I was like, oh yes, that's Lord An and that's Mu Yong, but I don't think they ever referred to the Crown Prince as anything but Your Highness, so I never remembered his name until I'm looking at the document, like the background documents again. So I don't know, I feel like maybe some more subtitles or lower thirds or something might have been helpful.
Well, I don't know. Maybe I just retained it more. And, you know, I just, like, we pretty much referred to the prince as the prince for most of the last one, too. So that's just kind of where I was on him. But anyway, as some of you may remember, end of season 1 was like a big sort of call to arms where we have the prince, his followers, and Lord An. And, you know, they basically are preparing and have been preparing to face the hordes of the undead.
Which have they've taken over a huge swath of land in the south, is my recollection.
Yep.
And now they're like ringed in by a series of forts. And somehow inside that ring is Lord An's hometown of Sangju. Is that right? Because that's where a lot of the action takes place in this episode, is in and around Sangju.
Right. And, you know, the whole last season set up the premise that the undead they were not active during the day. And most people thought it was because of sunlight. Well, it turns out that that's not the case. It's actually heat specifically that keeps them at bay, like higher temperatures. But because the country is entering into winter, it is cold during the day. And so at the end of the last season, we saw their whole defenses starting, like we saw like just a horde of the undead coming at them in the sunlight. And they were like kind of taken aback because they were like, aren't they supposed to be sleeping?
They're completely screwed over by this development in the story. Yeah. I mean, at the end of the last season, they had just stayed up all night after staying up all day, creating the defenses for their little causeway defense battle with the two rafts on either side of the causeway, the fire pits and all these preparations that they'd made. And then they're like breaking down for the day to go rest and eat because they're like exhausted and starving when the horde arrives. And so it would have been helpful, I think, to reestablish that element of it. It was a desperate defense setting all that up at the end of last season. And then the beginning of this season, actually, we don't even start with this. There's actually a flashback scene, which really piqued my interest. I want to know all about 3 years ago and the war. Yep. I don't know about you. And I don't know if you've watched, since you watched the next episode, maybe you know more than I do, but I want to see exactly how that went down. Cause it sounds like it was not the same.
They don't give it to you. In the next episode, they hint a lot at different things about who knew what when.
Yeah.
And so they give you a little bit more information, but not as much as I think you want and I want at this point.
But what does Lord An know? What does he not regret? You know.
So basically, they, you know, 3 years ago, the Japanese were going to overrun the country, and they were in a really bad position. And so there was discussion about the resurrection plant, whether it could bring the dead back, and it gives you a little bit of information. So apparently if you inject the plant into the glabella.
Is that a thing? What's the glabella?
Glabella? I don't know. But anyway, it's a thing, apparently. It will bring somebody back, a body back within a certain number of hours. However, if the brain is damaged or the body's really damaged, it won't work. So that's an interesting bit of mythology that they've added to this.
Who is that conversation between? Is that the king and Doctor, the doctor?
That is Hak Ju.
That's Cho Hae-won Hak Cho?
Yeah.
Okay. I thought I didn't recognize him, and I thought maybe it was the emperor or the crown prince's dad.
And they're talking with their council about whether they should use this or not. Yeah. And then ultimately, clearly they did. And then it jumps. So they give you that little tantalizing bit of information. And then we see our people getting, you know, exhausted, ready to deal with these new hordes of zombies in the daylight. And
they,
you know,
really don't react fast enough.
They don't, but it's also they're tired. And, yeah. You know, the thing I kind of was, there was a couple of things I was wondering about their ideas of defense. And yeah, they did have an idea to set certain things on fire, but they didn't catch. I also think that, you know, that they can't really go into water. So that seemed to me like the obvious line of retreat if you were going to do it and do it a little bit more quickly than some of them did. But it did allow for some good hat showing and people running and some good sword play and to show the devastation and the overwhelming numbers of the undead. And then the retreat of the prince and Lord An was pretty cool. And then we also have Yunshin. He has the other group, and he and his group jump on a raft to go to Sanju, and they're separated from the crown prince. And
only for like a hot second. Yeah, I was kind of expecting that storyline to be more of a splinter parallel story, but they kind of join back together in moments. Like as soon as that initial holding the wall scene is really exciting. It's clear that it's not going to work as soon as all their fire traps, like you said, don't work, and they don't have both sides of the rafts shooting into the crowd. It's also so many more zombies, I think, than maybe even they were expecting. Right. But those cannons that they put through the portholes.
Oh, those were so cool.
They only get off a couple volleys before suddenly the zombies are like messing with them and they're shooting their own guys and it's tumbling. And then, oh my gosh, that little baby or the little kid zombie that crawls through the wall. How did you handle that, AJ?
I it was luckily fast and they didn't show you too much, but it was definitely really upsetting because it was like small and it got through.
Gnawing
on that guy's leg. And it's terrible.
And Muyong just finishes him off. I love how he just walks up and he aces a zombie and then aces his colleague before it even becomes an issue.
And that's like, so the thing that I was puzzled about is that they know that fire will take care of them. And so there was like a really cool moment where they had set up these pits covered with straw.
Yeah.
And they're all falling in. And of course, the numbers are just too many. But I was like, why aren't they like shooting arrows or doing something with flame to sort of create a barrier? Mm-hmm. But maybe it was just fast.
I think it's just too wet. Like there are a lot of scenes of mud in this episode, but you know, it's not like Frozen. So I think maybe that could have helped. Also, it didn't. There were a lot of scenes in the last season where you could see people's breath and you could see how cold it was. In this sequence, I couldn't really feel how cold it was. There were a couple of scenes between Biom and Sobi, C-O-B, where you could see their breath when they're out at the waterfall. And there's ice in that scene, too. There you feel the cold. At the wall fight, you don't necessarily feel the cold. And it's a small gripe, but I think that they could have done more to show that it is cold enough for these zombies to be out in the daylight.
Well, there is some mention when Yunshin goes onto the raft and basically is like, do we want to freeze to death? But I think you're right. Until he says that, you're kind of like, is it that cold? I will also point out that there is a really not good moment, but it just kind of shows you that they know the deal when somebody gets bitten. The poor guy on the boat that's like, it's just a little bite. And they like they push him into the water and let him drown. It's like, oh, that's rough.
Well, honestly, yeah, I mean, it's probably really cold water because part of me was like, well, if it's not such a bad bite, you swim along with us and we'll all get there together.
Actually, what I thought was going to happen, I thought somebody was like going to just cut his arm off or something. Like, I really thought that's where they were going. But no, they just drown him and leave him behind. And then they get reunited with the prince and Lord An, the Yunshin
group. In that trench,
which also seems like a bad idea. And there's this really insane scene And again, it's like they're all like, we need to prepare, and they start like carving like spears and stuff. It's like, guys, this isn't gonna work.
It wasn't clear to me why they were down to spears at that point, you know? Were all just like using bamboo weapons.
They have swords, some of them, and knives, some of them. And the gate is unfortunately locked, and they have to get through it. There's a big chain. And then they manage to break it, but they've damaged the frame of the door in the process of getting the chain off.
You remember they're showing doors, right?
Yeah.
The jail cells that they would just run through?
Yeah, that's when I'm like, this doesn't seem like a good idea. So this is a little implausible, but we've got, is it Byam Il, who is the
main... The governor of Dongne?
Yeah, yeah. So he basically, they show that his hand's been bitten, and he wraps himself in the chain.
Oh, no, that's not Byam.
No. You're thinking Byam.
Byam is with Sobi.
No, but the other guy, isn't he also Byam?
I think
the one
his
who sacrifices
name
himself?
Is Deok Sung, isn't he? And in the supporting cast on the wiki, I don't know that I never ever knew this guy's name, but in the wiki, he is referred to as Lord An's loyal right hand man. He's also the guy who was shooting two arrows at a time. He was pulling a full Legolas at the wall fight.
He was awesome. But anyway, his hand gets bitten. And he wraps himself in the chain and creates a barrier, again, a little unlikely, and then stabs himself in the belly to hold, you know, he's basically like a bit of a human shield, although let's all just be honest, this would not have worked.
Yeah, couldn't they just bite through him eventually?
Or push him through, I don't know. In any case, but
apparently it does work because they come back to him later.
It does. You know, there's this whole sacrifice that he makes, and they're all sobered by this. And then Yun Qin puts him out of his misery because he's still like dying while all the dead are up behind him. So he stabs him in the head.
I really did not feel enough of a sense of urgency in a lot of this, like, because like you and I are saying, he's not going to be able to hold that door closed against the hundreds of zombies that are outside.
Right.
But and Yang Xin is just kind of slowly walking up to him to like underline and underscore the, you know, seriousness of this hero's death. But I kind of would have preferred it if Yang Xin had just run up, stabbed him in the head, and run away again.
Well, yeah, they wait the group waits a really long time to get away, which it's like, you guys shouldn't wait to see if it holds. You should get the heck out of there.
Yeah.
But anyway, so there is that group of people. In the same sort of segment, they switch to Shobi. Byam Pei, isn't it?
Byam Il?
Is it Byam Il? I thought it was
Byam Pal. Byam.
Byam, our magistrate. So he is with her, and they had been sort of scoping out, just to remind everybody, they'd been scoping out the area where the resurrection flower has been growing. And she is the one who figures out that it's the higher temperatures that have kept them at bay. So we get that bit of information from her. And then, you know, she's got an idea to kind of crawl upstream with the magistrate. And they're going to seek, safety with Cho Hak Ju.
Yeah. Well, she's like, you said that you had a chit to hand in to the Cho Hei Wan clan, and let's do it. Let's go. And it'll be safer than going back to where the crown prince is. And it looks like that's true, because the next time we see them, there isn't even like a long montage of them traveling upstream to, I can't pronounce the name of the place where Cho Hei Wan army is set up. It's like Hmong something. But the next time we see them, they're there and prostrating themselves before.
Yep. His dad.
Well, and uncle, I think.
Uncle, dad. Anyway, his uncle is basically like really disdainful. He's like, you didn't take care of the prince. In fact, you let him get away. And he assassinated
my son.
And basically says, well, but you're lucky you have the blood you have through your veins. So has mercy on him.
He acknowledges that Byam Pal, or whatever, the Dongne governor, is the sole now heir of the Cho Hei Wan clan.
Right.
Big deal.
Yeah, pretty big deal, because the other guy's dead. So Shobi, so and then they're very interested in who Shobi is, and she basically says that he says that she worked with the king's physician, and they basically there's definitely interest in that, and so they, because obviously they know about the resurrection flower, and they allow her to stay as well. But it's a very tense thing, and you don't necessarily get a good feeling about their safety in this particular situation.
No. And later when Cho Hak-ju walks up to them with his retinue of 20 guards, and they're like looking at the resurrection plant, and it has all those weird eggs under the leaves.
Yep. Yep.
It's definitely a, medicine man type moment. Did you ever see that movie, the Sean Connery?
Yeah. The ants and the sugar.
The ants and the sugar bowl. yeah, it's that moment of the show where they're like, wait, is it the plant or is it something that maybe grows on it? So we'll find out. But then Cho Hak-ju takes the plant, connects the dots that CLB has read the doctor's notes and knows more about the resurrection plant and its effects.
Yep.
And is like, I'm taking her to Anyang now. Yep. Also, Biom, I assume, is going to go with. And so they are piecing out from Mong Xiong, these names, man.
I know.
They're piecing out from their base of operations, which is a little bit funny because that's where, by the end of this episode, the Crown Prince is dashing off to get to there.
Yep. Also, we should mention that Shobi she's talking to the magistrate about potentially figuring out a way to reverse the disease. And says something like, every disease has a cure. And that is definitely, I don't think it's something that Hak-ju is going to want her to do.
He's like the only guy in all of Joseon, who doesn't want this disease to end.
Right. So, you know, there is that. And then we've also got where the prince and everybody's rushing off. The other side story is about the queen, and we just chose the refresher. She's been doing some pretty nefarious things. She's faking a pregnancy. She's brought all these women to supposedly keep them safe, but really it's because she wants to steal one of their babies if it's a son. And man, all these women, just the odds that all these women had daughters is pretty weird, but apparently every time each woman has a daughter, they are killed and their daughter is strangled, and this has come to light with some of the guards.
Because they're apparently terrible at hiding the evidence, and they just throw the bodies outside their gates.
Right. But one, I think, actually was was alive or barely alive, and she was found. They're off to try to figure out this murder mystery. Anyway, the queen has this weird little thing going on with her.
She's doing that thing with that witch in the nest.
Yeah, that's really strange. But basically, they remind the audience that she's waiting for a son so that she can claim the throne, and that her father can never know that she didn't actually birth the son.
She's plotting against her own dad, who is also a cold-blooded SOB. So very, it's like plots within plots. Cho Hae-won, not necessarily people to be trusted, except for Biom. He seems okay. As long as he's not given any power, he should and doesn't have bad advisors, he should be fine. Clearly, he's getting set up to be the ruler of anything that Cho Hae-won had left by the end of the series.
Right. And then we should probably talk about the food issue at the Citadel.
Well, and the Prince Li Chang and Mu Yong scene where the prince is suspecting Mu Yong of treachery. Mu Yong is I left my pregnant wife with the queen's staff unwittingly. I came with you. I've helped you. He saved the prince's life more times than I can remember. So I was a little bit taken aback by this. But the prince is convinced that he's got a mole. Somebody told them that they were coming. Somebody told the imperial, like the Cho Hae-wons, that they were going to be here. And that's why they're all locked out. But they don't really get to resolve that. Even by the end of this episode, the prince is still kind of giving stink eye to Mu Yong, and Mu Yong is just like, sir, I'm going to do whatever I have to help you.
Right. but you definitely feel like there's some trust broken there, and so that's not yet resolved. And then while this is going on, there is a food issue, and Lordan, you know, basically like says that, you know, they this is like already precarious, and then the whole food store catches fire. And actually, this reminds me a little bit of what's happening with the pandemic, because how this happened is that one of the guards was like, oh, I'm going to take some food for my own family, and dropped a lantern and basically caused the whole food store to burn down. And it's sort of like, if you don't, I feel like the messaging is this, is like, if you're not acting alongside the interests of everybody, everybody will be damaged, you know? Mm-hmm. So I felt like that was an interesting commentary.
It was, because it wasn't like it wasn't super nefarious. It was almost innocent, but it also, yeah, like you basically spelled it out. But I wasn't sure how the scene was going to unfold, because Lord An and the prince are both kind of bystanders for this scene. It's being played out almost entirely by the guard, and then that one guy who does fess up to it. I'm not sure if he was a guard or just a noble. He was wearing a hat,
which
typically denotes noble, right? But the guards are like beating each other up, like, you fell down on the job. And it's very curious how the scene, kind of in an absence of leadership, unfolds with with a confession. And at the end of it, everybody's kind of just like, oh, yeah, that sucks. We're all going to die.
Yep. But this is also what spurs them to get moving, the prince and Lord An. Yeah. And they're like, okay, well, we're going to have to take care of business now even more quickly, because otherwise everybody's just going to die.
And we also have that little scene that Mu Yong tries to tell the prince about, but the prince isn't wanting to hear from Mu Yong at that moment, because one of Lord An's men is talking to him, and he's like, hey, 3 years ago, this is not how the zombies were doing. Like, I'm wondering what's going on. They used to not, their bite didn't make other zombies. They only attacked other humans. I think he mentions one other thing, and maybe it was about coming out during the daylight. And Lord An is like, I regret nothing. This is fine. Everything is fine. So, well, that's really just continuing to pique my interest, really wanting to get back into that flashback, words that I didn't think I would say, because I'm typically not a huge flashback fan.
Right.
But I want to know what happened 3 years ago so badly.
Right. And so they basically decide to get out of there, which is there's an interesting way that they do it, which is that they have some of the clerks jump on the wall and cut their hands to attract all the undead, which works. And they all go out the tunnel that they came in. And then we see another hat scene where the guard, the right hand, An's right hand man, they basically give him a lot of respect, and they take him out of the door. It does bother me that they don't show them chaining up that door again, but,
they're like, see ya, Sanju.
Yep. And they, you know, and then they're heading it to, where Hakju is, and the prince is basically like, he's gonna die. I'm gonna take care of business.
I'm going to kill the chancellor.
Yep.
I was like, yeah, you know what? That's actually, yeah, that's probably a pretty good goal at this point in the story. So go for it, Prince.
Yep.
I don't know. It's going to be kind of hard to get to him. And I think that they're going to miss one another because he's going on young. Anyway, this episode doesn't actually have a whole lot of moving parts, but it is like there's that huge, massive opening set piece of the wall fight on the causeway. And then there's the action in Songju. There's COB and Biom. And their interactions and getting to the Chancellor's base. And between all those things, they fill up about an hour of television. And it was pretty darn fun to be back in this world. It's just that I do wish I'd had a name primer to get back with all those names. Yang Xin, I did not remember his name at all, because nobody really refers to him by name.
Nope. But we know who he is.
Out of curiosity, did you watch this English dub or Korean subtitles?
I think I didn't necessarily have a choice. So I think it was English dub and English subtitles. Or I guess that's just what it selected, and I did not change it. Okay. But usually I like it to be not English dubbed.
I started with English dub and then switched to Korean after Seobi and Byom climbed up the waterfall. Just to hear, I have a feeling that a lot of the dub is done by the actors. I don't know why I feel like that's the case. the princess has a very strong accent in English. So I prefer listening to some of it in Korean and reading the subs.
Yeah, no, I agree with you. And I didn't, I guess I forgot that I had that choice. So I just let Netflix do what it was going to do. In any case, that is it for this episode. Looking forward to rewatching episode 2.
Sorry.
Are we going to do 2, 3, and 4 then?
If you wish. Yes, happy to.
I think that's what episode 2 is shorter. It's only 40 minutes or like 39 minutes. So, in any case, I'm excited about this. I loved this opening. I think they did a good job at setting everything up with this particular episode. And so can't wait to talk about the rest of the season with you.
Hear, hear. So join us again next time on Reanimated for episodes 2, 3, and 4 of season 2 of Kingdom. And we will hit that. And then hopefully by the time we're done with Kingdom, we can watch a little Blood Quantum.
Yeah.
And then everything will be back to normal.
Yeah, yeah, right? Uh-huh. Let's hope. Let's hope. And did you want to take us out?
Sure thing. Okay, yeah. So you can tweet at us on ReanimatedPcast. You can send us emails at reanimatedpodcast@gmail.com, and our show notes will be online at reanimatedpodcast.com with the links to all those things that we talked about at the top of the show. So thank you for listening, and goodbye.
Ciao.